Let me open with a word of prayer. Dear Lord, our Heavenly Father, you are indeed heavenly. You're the one who created the heavens and the earth, one has authority over all things. You created man in your image, male and female, and there is no human authority except from you, for indeed all human authorities have been delegated by you and are accountable to you in how they govern. And Lord, I pray that you'd give us wisdom as Americans to understand our glorious heritage in Western civilization. As we think now about Rome and begin our journeys through Rome, help us to understand the good things that they were involved in their kingdom, in their republic, in their empire. And I pray, dear Lord, that in our day that you would repair our ruins and restore our race for the glory of the risen Lord Jesus Christ, who is over all things. Be merciful to us and our republic. In Christ's precious name we pray. Amen. Well, as you know, we have traveled so far through Jerusalem, through Athens, and now we're traveling through Rome, and then, Lord willing, we'll travel through London to America. The reason that Athens and Rome are included in Western civilization is primarily because it is where republics began. As we saw when we went through Athens, through ancient Greece, Rome began as kings and then moved into a republic. And it was a very long republic, as we shall see, over 500 years as a republic. And then it moved into an empire and then was overcome by the risen Lord Jesus Christ in Christianity. There's really two sources for the American Republic. And we could say the Greco-Roman world and Jerusalem. And Jerusalem, obviously, we're referring to ancient Israel. We spent many classes on Jerusalem. But think of it as the doctrine of concurrence. We've talked about the doctrine of concurrence before with God's sovereignty and human freedom. Where God is sovereign over human beings, Proverbs 21:1, he turns the king's heart like channels of water in his hand. And yet the king is still free and responsible. He doesn't lose his freedom, his free agency, or his responsibility. And yet God's sovereign over the king, as he is sovereign over me and you as humans. But two rivers that flow together is the idea with concurrence. We know, as we said when we went through Jerusalem and we're thinking about America and the introduction of this course, that in Romans chapter 13, verses 1 through 10, the main text that we have in the New Testament on Gentile civil governments, it does not demand a particular form of government. It does not say we must have a monarchy, an aristocracy, or a democracy. And as we've noted when we went through Athens, a republic is a mixed government. A republic is a mixed government, and it has shades of all three. In America, our founders designed the American Republic where the presidency would be the best of monarchy. And we will see that a bit with the imperial power that we'll be looking at with Rome, that the king was invested with. But in America as well, the Senate, as we're going to see with the Roman Republic, it's from an old term, a Latin term, senex, for old men. And it was the heads of the patrician families, the wealthy aristocratic families. The Senate is to be the best of aristocracy in the U.S. Senate. And the U.S. House in our Congress was meant by our founders to be the best of democracy. So in the presidency, the best of monarchy, the U.S. Senate, the best of aristocracy, and the U.S. House, the best of democracy. Senators serve for six-year terms. Originally, they were elected by the state legislatures, not we the people. That changed in 1913 to make it more democratic, which typically, as we will see, we saw it with the Republic in Athens, and it's typical of republics. Over time, they tend to become more democratic. We'll see it with the Republic of Rome as well. But the Senate is to be the best of aristocracy in the United States, serving each senator serving six-year terms. Every 2 years, only a third of them are up for election. It's meant to be stable. It's meant to have change to take place very slowly. The U.S. House, though, is meant to be the best of democracy, where everyone's elected their 435 members every 2 years by the people. So it's change takes place quick in the U.S. House. It's meant to be. Well, we're going to see that some of these aspects with the Republic of Rome, and we're also going to see checks and balances that were there within the Kingdom of Rome. So as we will see, Rome began with kings for about 250 years and then moved into a republic for about 500 years before an empire. Rome was pagan. We've noted that as well with Athens. They embraced many of the gods and goddesses of ancient Greece. We've said that civilization is the cultural characteristics of a people group. So we're speaking about America and Western civilization. Civilization refers to the cultural characteristics of a people group. So what is the culture? The core of that is the cult, and that is from the Latin and the French terms cultus and culte, that refer to the overall religious worship and devotion of a people group. So the overall religious worship and devotion of a people group, its cult, determines its culture, determines its morals and its values, its behaviors, how it structures society, and that in turn determines its laws. Its laws flow out of that. One of the unique things that the Apostle Paul wrote to the church at Rome in the first century AD was in Romans 2:15, where he said that they show the work, the Gentiles, the Greco-Roman world, shows the work of the law written in their hearts. We have seen that with Athens. We covered the philosophers, pre-Socratic, as well as Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. By and large, they certainly acknowledged objective reality. They were scientists, the pre-Socratics. We as Christians believe in objective reality. We're realists. And also in the moral realm, as we saw with Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, as they argued against the sophists, they argued that morals are as well objective, outside of our little minds, where the sophists were just subjectivists and relativists, that universal words to them are playthings and can mean anything, like justice and fairness, truth. Well, because the Greco-Roman world shows the work of God's law written in their heart. It's not perfect, but it's the work shown, where it is seen somewhat in their legal system. They had laws for marriage and other things, as we shall see. But because God does restrain evil by His grace, total depravity does not mean utter depravity, and therefore we can learn things from the pagans. As the Apostle Paul, in his sermon in Acts 17, quoted their own poets in Acts chapter 17 at the Areopagus at Mars Hill, that even your own poets have said that we are all his offspring. He as well knew the Greco-Roman world and knew that just because they're pagans doesn't mean everything they say is false. And you and I as well, and the founders of America, which were by and large Christians, knew that they could learn quite a bit from the Greco-Roman world. Now, I'll have more to say on this in the next class when we think about the expansion of the Republic. So today we're introducing Rome when it began and how it was ruled by kings for roughly 250 years and then moved into an aristocratic republic for about 500 years. We're going to be introducing the aristocratic republic And then the next class we'll be looking at the expansion of it, how they grew wide and broad and powerful across the Middle East and Western Europe. The American founders, as we shall see, Russell Kirk notes this, political science scholar in the 20th century, but Russell Kirk noted that the American founders studied Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. They studied Athens and ancient Greece. But the republics were short-lived. You remember that the golden age of the Republic of ancient Greece lasted only about 50 years. They studied Solon and his reforms of the laws in Athens in 594 BC, because that was at the beginning of the Republic of Athens. So they were interested at the beginning of the American Republic for pondering Solon and his reforms, what made Athens successful. But they knew that the Republic of Athens, as well as the other ones, didn't last very long. There was a lot of infighting. But with Rome, something's different. With Rome's Republic, it lasted a very long time. And they wanted a successful, long-lasting republic in America. So they were able to read Polybius, as we shall also cover and look at a little bit, his histories that he wrote. He lived in the 2nd century B.C. He was a Greek that lived in Rome as a hostage, but he was there and he ended up being even a counselor to the principal people in Rome. But he wrote his histories and made lots of comments about the Republic of Rome and why it was successful and then why it declined. But the American founders studied Polybius' writings, the histories, very carefully, the founders of America, and knew then a lot about Rome's Republic. And we're going to see they had a lot of wisdom to make it last in Rome's Republic. So, even though Rome had pagan beginnings and it had shortcomings, every nation, just like every individual, has shortcomings. If you look at me, you'll be able to find faults. If I analyze you carefully, I'll be able to find faults. Same with America or any nation. But the reason that Rome is included in Western civilization is because of their overall commitment to ordered liberty and the rule of law, and because they existed for a very long time as an aristocratic republic, a very successful republic. They engaged as well in innovative expansion, granting citizenship to foreigners, to other tribes, which was a new innovation at that time. We had unique innovations with the American Republic of how we would add states, how we would have territories expanding west from the 13 original states and be able to say, how do we add states? Well, they're territories and become a certain size and be Republican, and therefore then they could request statehood at some point in time for federal citizenship. And this is where we had also a way for expansion, and that's where you can look at Rome and say, how did they expand? And there was a way of expanding through granting citizenship. But they also had unique forms of federalism with dual citizenship of, they called it municipality, but allowing someone to have local citizenship and kind of govern their local tribe and community while also being a citizen of the Roman Republic. And we as well, if I asked you and say, are you a citizen of Minnesota? You say, yeah, I'm a citizen of Minnesota, but also you're also a citizen of the United States, aren't you? Yes. Well, that's something unique that was taking place in the Roman Republic that they came up with as a way of expanding, but yet allowing local governance and citizenship, but as well citizenship in the main republic itself, that form of federalism. It's one of the reasons then why they are included in Western civilization and in our history as Americans. What's also interesting, obviously, many of you are Christians, I would assume, and we rejoice in the Lordship of Jesus Christ over all things, and as you know, through Constantine and his conversion to Christianity in the early 300s A.D., Rome ended up being overcome by Christianity. That is one of the main reasons as well that Rome is included in Western civilization. In other words, Jerusalem overtook Rome. So we began with Jerusalem and then traveled through Athens because of the beginning of the republics as forms of government. Again, remember, Romans 13, 1 through 10 does not demand any particular form of government. It just says that the Gentile civil government should wield a sword as a minister of God, wielding the sword against evil. And what are quoted in Romans 13, verse 9, are commandments from the second table of the Ten Commandments. Of thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not bear false witness, right? Examples from the second table of the Ten Commandments with neighborly relations. So Gentile civil governments must have certain laws under God, but the form of government they take is up to them. And what's really interesting is in our U.S. Declaration of Independence, when we declared independence from Great Britain in 1776, it declares in there that whatever form of government we choose is up to us. They do not demand in there either that we have to have a republic form of government. That it is up to the people to determine what's best for themselves as to what form of government they pick. We just happen to pick republican form of government and believe that that's the best for freedom. And as we shall see in the history of Athens and with Rome, we do believe it's the best. And as we said when we went through Jerusalem, of all the 40-something kings, when the kingdom split after Solomon, 10 tribes in the north, 2 tribes in the south, you had Israel in the north, Judah in the south, none of the kings in the north were good. None, not one. And just a few in the south were good. So of all those kings, just a few were good. And up in there, you know, they had problems themselves. And then we fought a war against Great Britain in 1776. Why? Because our rights were being abused, our rights of Englishmen, our God-given rights. Therefore, we then chose a republican form of government, being better than a monarchy. But if you have a good monarch, things can go well in a monarchy. Obviously, there's the idea that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And we're going to see that with Rome. They have an observation of that when they leave the kingdom and go to the republic and what they pick to replace the king. Keep that in the back of your mind. Okay, so those are various reasons we include Rome within Western civilization. I want to stress again, this whole course, America and Western Civilization, is on the premise that all cultures are not equal. All civilizations are not equal. Some are better than others. I'm a proud American. I'm proud of my Western civ roots. I believe Western civilization is the best civilization on planet Earth by the grace of God. In other words, I'm telling you, diversity is not our strength. Import all sorts of people from different civilizations. Diversity is not our strength. If Western civ is better than all of the civilizations, don't tell me diversity is our strength. We want them to assimilate to Western civ and to understand the principles of Western civilization. What makes Western civ and American republic tick? What makes it succeed and be successful, right? Because we believe it's better than other civilizations, right? For freedom and prosperity, right? The first freedom in the Bill of Rights, religious freedom. And all other freedoms too. We believe the republic is best. Okay, so let's think about Rome here. This is the introduction, getting into Rome, the city of Rome. The city of Rome began as a small village on the western side of Italy, which is in the north-central part of the Mediterranean Sea. And being such a small village, Russell Kirk, political scientist in the 20th century, he said, quote, its beginnings were far more humble than Jerusalem or Athens. It was a very, 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 very tiny village, Rome. Geography helped its growth. It was at the center of one of the most fertile plains in central Italy and on the banks of central Italy's most important river, the Tiber River. At the time of its humble beginning, no one would have guessed that it would one day govern the entire Mediterranean Sea and way beyond, extending all the way north in Western Europe to Scotland, to Mesopotamia, the present-day Iraq, and from Germany to Morocco in northwest Africa. From a very small village, no one ever would have guessed how big it would become. Rome was initially governed by kings for 250 years, as I've said, and it functioned for over 500 years as an aristocratic republic, and then eventually becoming a mammoth empire. So the kingdom of Rome Rome, the name itself is named after its founder, a man named Romulus. And by legend, by myth, Rome was founded by Romulus as its king in 753 BC. 753 BC. And if you remember that period of time, the archaic age of ancient Greece, after the Dark Age, the depopulation period of ancient Greece, but that whole area in the Mediterranean was depopulated, and people began to come back to ancient Greece at that time, and it was being settled and forming various republics after their monarchies. As well, here we have Romulus founding Rome in Italy. Italy is west of Greece, as you know. A leading historian on ancient Greece says that the founding of Rome is, quote, one of the most famous myths in history. One of the most famous myths in history. One of the struggles of historians is there's not much for written history at that time. A lot was done with oral passing on of understanding of what took place through oral traditions, oral communication, and therefore a lot was legend and myth. As with the Greeks, the Romans were pagans, and man-made myths played an important role in their cultural ethos, providing unique explanations for their tribal identity and events in the world around them. Now, this legend comes in different forms because it was through oral tradition, but its essential features are as follows. So I'm going to read one of the leading scholars' summary of this legend. I kind of wrote just main points of it on the board there. But this is what one scholar writes. He says, Romulus and Remus were twins born to Ilia, the daughter of Numitor. Numitor was their grandfather. He was the rightful king of Alba Longa, but had been deposed by his brother, Amulius. Amulius had made Ilia a vestal virgin to ensure that she could not bear offspring, but she was raped by Mars, the god of war, and gave birth to twin sons. When Amulius found out, he had her imprisoned and the twins set adrift on the Tiber River in a basket to drown. They miraculously survived and were washed up on the shores of the Palatine at the site of the Lupercal, the cave where the she-wolf nursed them. They were suckled by a she-wolf and then picked up by the shepherd Faustulus, and raised by him and his wife as his own sons. As young men, they lived in a band with runaways and outlaws and raided neighboring settlements. On coming of age, the twins killed Amulius, the illegitimate king of Alba, and set their grandfather Numitor back on the throne. They got revenge, they got justice. Then they determined to found a city on the site of their salvation, along the Tiber River where a she-wolf rescued them. Romulus chose the Palatine and Remus the Aventine. And different augural symbols occurred, and they disputed who was the rightful founder. So what symbols would the gods bring them as to which is the rightful place to have the city of their salvation? Romulus fortified the Palatine, but Remus jumped over the half-built walls, and in the ensuing melee, Remus was killed, and Rome came to be named after Romulus. Very unique legend involving raiding, involving deposing of a king, involving retribution and justice and killing. But that's one of the most famous myths in history. Citizens of Rome knew it hundreds and hundreds of years later. Now, to populate the newly formed city of Rome, Romulus created an area for refugees to live from neighboring cities seeking asylum. So ancient Italy was then populated by many distant and separate tribal city-states. You remember that's what ancient Athens and all of Greece, it was kind of all of the various tribal states, right? And Sparta, Corinth, Thebes, Athens, all of the various small city-states, tribes. But they were tribes, they were tribal groups. And every tribal group was loyal to their tribe. Just like in North America, when the colonists ended up in North America, the English colonists, what did we have? North American Indian tribes, Native American Indian tribes. And they were all fighting one another. And what we saw in ancient Greece is they basically never got along. They were always fighting one another. Well, Romulus, though, he needs people to populate his new city. So he said, as king, he said, quote, "I will admit as citizens whoever choose to come. I will admit as citizens whoever choose to come." This core cultural attitude of granting citizenship to foreigners will eventually shape the growth of the Roman Republican Empire. Very similar to America, to a certain extent, a land of immigrants, granting citizenship to foreigners. Well, they needed women to marry. The Romans seduced the neighboring Sabines, another tribal group, to attend a festival, at which time they captured the Sabine women. Romulus's wife subsequently persuaded him to grant the Sabine women a share of non-voting citizenship and possessions. That's something unique with Rome as well, is granting people citizenship, but in a non-voting sense. Now, when the Sabine men initiated a war with Rome to retrieve their women, the Sabine women ran into battle seeking peace because their Roman husbands had treated them kindly and they had become fond of their new homes. That myth is called the rape of the Sabine women because they were kidnapped. But they were treated very well, granted non-voting citizenship and possessions, and their husbands treated them well. So their founding myths explain several things. Think about it a minute. Their founding myths explain the ethnic diversity of the city of Rome, their strong marriages and family ties, that the women who they kidnapped didn't want to be sent back, they were treated so well, their openness to extend citizenship to other tribal groups, and we will see that with the growth of the Republic, as well why Rome regarded women to some extent as equal partners, as one scholar puts it. Rome, more than Greece, sought to live an ethical lifestyle. According to Cicero, who died 43 BC, Lord willing, we'll study more of Cicero the next class. American founders read Cicero faithfully. According to Cicero, who died 43 BC, Romulus founded the city of Rome some 19 miles inland on the Tiber River, but 19 miles inland from the Mediterranean Sea, to prevent it from suffering the corrupt lifestyle typical of full-blown seaports. The Tiber River flows into the Tyrrhenian Sea, is what they call it, right next to the Tiber River, and then that's in the North Mediterranean Sea. But as you and I know today, cosmopolitan seaports are known for more corruption. Nothing new under the sun, as Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes. But according to Cicero, it's one of the reasons why Romulus founded the city of Rome 19 miles inland. But their founding legend would say it was on the site of their salvation by the she-wolf. Just in personal ethics, let me just say a word on that. I didn't put anything on the board on it and been debating when to say it, but I didn't stress it as much perhaps with Athens, but ancient Greece They were always fighting. They were not known to be ethical people, typically. One of the common sayings was, someone from Greece will tell you the truth, but what, once a year? Another saying, never trust a person from Greece. Rome was different, actually, for their reputation. Romans, they were different in their reputation. But that scholars will bring that out with perhaps what made them so successful for a long time was they showed the work of the law written in their heart. They have many failings, no doubt, a pagan society, but they show the work of God's law written in their heart, Romans 2:15, with strong family ties, in a sense, openness to extend citizenship to other tribal groups, stronger marriages. I say that because, remember, one of the things that Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle stressed as philosophers of ancient Greece was that a successful republic depends upon a moral people, an ethical people. Because a republic is self-governed people. It's self-government. If you're just a monarchy, all you are is a subject, and you just do what you're told. The king governs. He commands you, and you do it. But in a republic, we govern ourselves through representatives. It's self-government, but it depends upon people who are self-controlled, meaning self-governed in their own individual lives. But that depends on a moral people. And we believe, ultimately, as the American founders, that depends upon Christianity, ultimately, to maintain that morality. Now, King Romulus was followed by six other kings. So, total, there were seven kings. And these seven kings ruled the city of Rome from 753 BC to 509 BC. During this time, Roman society was composed of several different groups. Patricians. Patricians were wealthy landowning aristocrats. Roman society was also composed of slaves, also composed of what they called clients. Clients, and those were people who were strangers or freed slaves. They were clients. As well, Roman society had a great multitude of plebeians. Plebeians. Common, poor farmers, folk farmers. And if you want to say middle-class farmers. We saw that with Athens. We saw that with ancient Greece. Is one of the things that makes a republic work is a successful middle class where they manage their own businesses, their own farms. They're used to governing themselves. And therefore, to be a republic works. Jerusalem as well, and Israel, God allotted land, you remember, and in the year of Jubilee, everything reverted back to everyone's family ownership. God made sure that there would never become just a few who owned most of the land and were the main landlords. God always had the land revert back to their family lines in Israel. And God made sure then that there was diversity spread out among the people for land ownership and farms in Israel and Jerusalem. As we said, they were both citizens and subjects. And there's a unique aspect in ancient Israel of being both. But in Roman society, there were patricians, the wealthy landowning aristocrats, slaves. There were clients. Clients were strangers or freed slaves, as well as plebeians, common folk farmers. And they were the majority were the plebeians, sometimes referred to as the plebes. The plebes. During the reign of the kings, patricians could only marry other patricians. So wealthy aristocrats could only marry other wealthy aristocrats during the period of the kings in ancient Rome. And only a male patrician was allowed to vote as a citizen and hold political office in ancient Rome. Only men, and at the time only men who were wealthy aristocrats, the patricians, could vote. The plebes did not gain full citizenship until the Republic period. Until the Republic period. And if I recall correctly, 286 BC is when the plebes got full citizenship after several secession efforts. We'll mention that a little bit at the end of the class in the conflict of the orders during the Republic period. Though initially governed by kings and wealthy land-owning patricians, Rome from the beginning was known for the rule of law and ordered liberty, which are core principles of Western civilization. And we see it in Rome's structured civil government. The government of Rome under the kings, that 250-year period of the seven kings, the government of Rome was carried on by the king, the Senate, and the citizens. The king, the Senate, and the citizens. The king acted as priest, so they had pagan gods and goddesses. The king acted as priest, ruler, and commander of the armed forces, the military. It's referred to in Latin as the imperium power. And this is why in all of the ancient world, anyone who was the head of the state in Rome had the imperium power as the chief executive. And when we get to the period of the emperors, they had the imperial power. And that's where when Constantine was converted to Christianity, that's why he believed he was the head of the church, not just the head of the state. Because that's the way they always were. That chief ruler with the imperial power was the main priest, the head of the religious group for society. And that's where Constantine took that on in the early 300s AD. But in the period of the kings, the seven kings of ancient Rome, the king acted as priest, ruler, and commander. It's referred to as the imperium. That is, he was the religious head of the Romans. He governed them in time of peace, and he led them in battle in time of war. Commander-in-chief. So the U.S. president is the commander-in-chief of our armed forces. And this is the sense in which the U.S. president is to be the best of monarchy. Okay? And this is an aspect of that, taking that part of that from ancient Rome. Say, you're the commander-in-chief. Now, in the period of the kings, the king had a right to name his successor, who would succeed him when he was done as the monarch at the end of his life. How about the Senate? The Senate was composed of elderly men selected from the heads of the patrician families. So the patrician were the wealthy owning aristocrats, the wealthy land-owning aristocrats. The elderly male head of each of those families composed the Senate. And there are basically 100 members in their Senate during the times of the kings. Okay. It took its name from the Latin word senex, meaning an old man. That's what the Latin word senex means. No resolution could become law without the Senate's approval at the time of the kings of Rome for the 250-year period. No resolution could become law in that period of the kings of Rome without the approval of the Senate. The Senate also acted as a special advisor to the king. And if he died without naming a successor, then the Senate had the power to nominate the next king, the next sovereign. The citizens, that is the patricians, the other younger, male, wealthy aristocrats, the citizens, took part in the government by voting in the assembly of the curiae, known as the comitia curiata. I think where we get the word committee, committee, but an assembly is where the rest of the patricians, the younger patricians, the male wealthy aristocrats, they took part in the government and they voted in the assembly. Each of the 30 curiae had one vote. So they were divided into 30 groups, the other male wealthy aristocrat men. They were divided into 30 groups. Each group had one vote. So if you had, whatever, if you had 43 people in there, you say, well, we're voting on Proposition A. Did the majority in that group vote yes or no? If the majority in that group voted yes, then there's one vote for A. You get me? That's how they function. It was not, and then we'll see this in the Republic, they were not committed to one person, one vote. As you see, the Supreme Court over time has moved America to this commitment almost to one person, one vote. Rome was not committed to that, and neither were we at our founding. But that's how they voted. They were put into 30 curiae, 30 groups, the other patricians, the other male patrician citizens, and then each of the groups, the curiae would get one vote based on the majority of what they would vote for. Laws might be proposed in this assembly either by the assembly itself or by the king, but it could not become law without the approval of the Senate, the old patricians, the old men in the Senate. So the assembly could vote to approve a bill, in a sense, to be law, but it would not become law until the Senate approved it. And no king, whether named by the preceding ruler or nominated by the Senate, could take possession on the throne until the assembly had given its consent. So the king had a right to name his successor. If he failed to do so, the Senate had a right to pick his successor, but whoever that successor would be could not be confirmed as king until the assembly voted yes. What do you see in all of this within the kingdom of Rome? What you see is clear marks of a civil government with checks and balances between the king, the Senate, and the assembly. Checks and balances between them. And that's one big mark we have in the American Republic. Checks and balances, and that consent was needed by different entities for approval of certain measures. So there is a sense in which we can call the initial kingdom of Rome a monarchical republic. I haven't read that by any scholar. That's my opinion. But I believe you could call it a monarchical republic. A mixed government in which the king dominates the decisions of the polis, is the priest, the head of their church, their pagan gods and goddesses, pagan religion, is commander-in-chief in time of war, king is, leads for peace treaties, etc., can name his successor, can propose a bill for law, but he's checked and he's balanced by the Senate and the assembly. So there's a certain sense, and yes, in which the king dominates the decisions of the polis, the political community, but he's balanced and checked by the Senate and the assembly of the other landowning patricians. And that's what you find. I'm going to bring this up at a later point, but what you find in each republic, we talked about it in Athens, in Sparta, in ancient Greece, ancient Spartans was a military aristocratic republic. They hated democracy in Sparta. In Athens, in ancient Greece, it was a democratic republic. Democracy flourished there in Athens. But that's one of the reasons why in the long Peloponnesian War, at the end of the 5th century, the end of the 400s, in that long war, what? They were fighting each other in their various leagues. They had two main leagues and they fought each other, Athens and Sparta. They were enemies of each other. And Sparta hated democracy. A republic is a mixed government, between a monarch, aristocracy, and democracy, but one of them dominates. Okay? That's where it's a mixed government, but which one of them tends to dominate. And which is it? Well, in the kingdom period, I'd say it was the kings. But it's still a mixed government, as you see with these checks and balances. In Athens, the assembly dominated, the democracy. In Sparta, in a sense, their senate, the aristocrats dominated in Sparta. Now, you remember as we traveled through Athens in ancient Greece that the tribal Greek city-states were constantly at war with one another. That was one of the big things. They could never get along. Well, the city-states peppered across ancient Italy were no different. War was an ever-present danger for every tribal group. I've said it before in North America with the Native American Indian tribes. I've got one book on my shelf called That Dark and Bloody River about the history of the Ohio River Valley. Native American tribes fighting one another with nothing but bloodshed everywhere. This is a common among human beings. We're fallen, sinful human beings in Adam, and we have tribal pride and typically do not get along with one another. Same with these various tribes peppered across ancient Italy. War was an ever-present danger for every tribal group. Significantly, after King Romulus's death, another founding myth said that a highly respected man received a vision he shared with the city of Rome. Quote, "The king bade me tell you," said the man, "that the gods decree Rome to become the capital of the world, and that if you cultivate the art of war, no human power will be able to withstand you." Then he vanished into the heavens. Believing this report, the Romans did indeed cultivate for their security the art of war. As they gained more and more land through military conquest under the Roman kings, stones were set up to mark boundaries for Roman farmers, establishing private property rights. We saw that with both Jerusalem, ancient Israel. It was a very serious crime to move the property boundary markers of ancient Israel in Jerusalem. It's the same within Rome. Private property rights were crucial. It's a part of Western civilization to defend private property rights. I've said it before in the Ten Commandments, in the second table of the Ten Commandments with neighborly relations. What do we have? Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not steal. Right? So, thou shalt not steal what is Amy's, which then presumes she has a right to her own private property. Right? That's what's stated in that commandment of God. Do not steal what belongs to another. God has declared to us that we have the right to the fruit of our labor, of what we own. And I just want to say it, as we have seen with ancient Greece, I pointed it out with Athens, and I think it was true in Jerusalem, where you have massive amounts of farmers running their own businesses. They make the best soldiers. Victor Davis Hanson, probably the leading historian we have on the ancient world, ancient Greece, and ancient Rome, he has written a book on that too and stated it multiple times. Why were they such good military fighters in ancient Greece and ancient Rome? Why? Because they were free people. They were people who owned their own land. And you run your own business. You determine when you plant. You determine when you harvest. You determine what you do with the product when you're done. What do you want to do with the olives? Huh? What do you want to turn them all into olive oil and then sell that in the market? What do you want to do with the grapes? Huh? What do you want to do with the crops you harvest? These decisions that are made. So then on the battlefield, who are the best soldiers? They're making their own decisions. In the fly, on their own, where somebody who just serves a king, they're a subject, and they just do what they're told, on the battlefield, if that's all they do, they're going to be dumb as a box of rocks. But you take free people who are used to governing themselves, and they'll make great decisions on the fly in the middle of the battlefield. And that's one of Victor Davis Hanson's arguments of why free people have the best militaries in the world. And I think that's also one of the successes of ancient Rome here, is during the period of the Roman kings, stones were set up to mark boundaries for Roman farmers, establishing private property rights, and you end up with these strong family ties and strong marriages and families with self-governing people managing their own affairs on the farm. It made them the best soldiers. Interestingly, during the period of the kings, a regular census was established in which a census was taken every 5 years. You know, in the United States of America, we have a census every 10 years. They had one every 5 years. The census recorded a list of the people of the state, their children, and the amount of their property. The Romans wanted to know, were you a patrician or a plebe? Are you a wealthy landowner or not? Or just a common folk farmer? They want to know, what are you worth? So they had a list of the people in the census, their children, and the amount of the property. Remember, the patricians, the wealthy landowners, are the ones who are the citizens, the one in the assemblies, the ones voting, the voting citizenship. They're also the soldiers, by the way, too, the men. Knowing the amount of property and the value of it that you have is going to become very important during the period of Rome's Republic, for providing the information necessary for allotting voting groups of men on the basis of their wealth. Okay? We're going to see that in Rome's Republic, when it forms, that they will be allotting voting groups on the basis of wealth. Very interesting. As well, when they took a census every 5 years and they knew the people in various areas, they could levy troops in a balanced way. So you could have military drafts in a balanced way of levering troops for the wars they fought. And we're going to see there was continual warfare that ended up taking place. They wanted different than, we're going to see, different than the Delian League by Athens in ancient Greece, where they wanted more tribute. They wanted more money. Remember, all the money flowing into Athens through the Delian League was mammoth on a per capita scale. Which is why then the democracy of Athens said, let's keep voting for war, because we're getting wealthy off this. Where in Rome, they wanted troops more than the tributat, more than the tax. They wanted for the legions, the military troops in fighting their war. Well, the census was critical on that, to be able to call up troops, but in a balanced way across the various colonies and tribes they had. Well, the seventh and last king of Rome. Say, how did the kingdom period end? It lasted around 250 years. Remember, Romulus founded Rome, 753 BC. It ends here, 509 BC. Seventh and last king of Rome was this king, Lucius Tarquinius. Interestingly, he committed so many evil deeds in his reign that people called him Tarquin the Proud. Well, driving the tyrant from the throne in 509 BC, the Romans declared that never again should a king reign over them. And they even decreed that if anyone should venture to say he wished a return of the kingly rule, he should be put to death as an enemy of the state. Do you think they hated a monarch? Down to the very heart and soul of their gut, they hated monarchy. If you even wish a return of kingly rule, we'll put you to death. But they declared never again should a king reign over them. So in 509 BC, the kingdom ceased and Rome became an aristocratic republic. Interestingly, it was the same year of the first Carthage Treaty, which Polybius dates to 509 BC, the exact same year. And remember, Polybius is the one who wrote the histories. He lived in the 2nd century BC. He was a Greek, was taken hostage, and was in the city of Rome, but he was one who actually ended up being a counselor to the principal people in Rome and wrote his histories of Rome. The American founders, that's what they read. They knew the Roman Republic primarily through Polybius's histories. Well, it's Polybius who noted that the first Carthage treaty, and remember, Carthage was a very old city-state in northwest Africa that was a longtime enemy of ancient Greece. But as well, Carthage challenged the security at this time of Rome. But what's interesting is the timing of the treaty, their first treaty, that one scholar in our day notes, Carthage must have been concerned to secure the friendship of the new republican regime at Rome. We need their friendship to make sure they're not our enemy either. They could threaten our security. Remember, war was a constant threat for any society at that point. And you were not treated well. Most women and young boys could get raped. Many turned into slaves. Sometimes all the men were mutilated and cut to pieces. It was a violent period of time. So you better develop a strong army and be ready to fight, or you're not going to last long. But this is where treaties and alliances were key to Rome's success as well. Another treaty between Carthage and Rome occurred in 348 BC. But throughout its history, Rome was skilled at making key alliances and treaties. Okay? It was really skilled at making alliances and treaties. So one of the ways they grew was making certain alliances as well as military conquest and colonization. They called it. They had a policy of colonization. I'll talk about that as well. So the aristocratic Republic of Rome, began 509 BC. Now, under the military leadership of their kings, Rome had built up a substantial empire within that rich agricultural plain called Latium. That rich agricultural geographic plain on the west side of Italy. So they had, by military conquest under the kings, acquired almost 24 tribal colonies that they governed within Latium, particularly it's mentioned in 495 BC, that they had at least 24, almost 24 tribal colonies that they governed. So that's what then the new republic has to govern. Rome's, just to make note here, I don't think I wrote that on the board, but Rome's colonizing policy during the kingdom and the republic involved settling Roman families in colonies next to Rome. So if any of the colonies were right near Rome, they would usually move Roman families to settle them and work the farms and live in them and grow them, okay? To take over them. You've got your own people. They're loyal to you. They're Romans. And then they would farm the land that was by military conquest and grow in that community. Later, during the 3rd century BC of the Republic, they settled other Latin families, not necessarily Roman families, but other Latin families in colonies that were away from Rome, and they functioned more as military garrisons while they farmed. Which, when you're growing, you need military outposts and garrisons, right? So that's where, but they would settle them with families. And that was a policy they had of colonization, to then move families, particularly a lot of the plebes, then out of the poor common folk. And as we shall see too, many of them complained of starvation for a period of time, and this is where they were able to get land to help them farm and feed their families, etc. Well, both the Senate and the Assembly remained as governing institutions in Rome. So they kicked out the king. So what's the Republic going to be like? Both the Senate and the Assembly remained as governing institutions in Rome, with a few minor changes. The Senate went from 100 members of the elite, old men, the elite, elderly heads of the patrician families, went from 100 members to having 300 senators, and it was based a bit more on merit rather than just because you're the old man of the extreme wealthy patrician family. But the assembly that had the other patrician males, the assembly, the Comitia Curiata, that Romulus had established and had been under the other kings, became known as the Assembly of the Tribes at this point, the Assembly of the Tribes, the Comitia Tributa. So they're growing in a sense, they're defeating other tribes, but then they're able to, in a sense, bring them in as citizens, other tribal groups. So then they're referring to the assembly more as the Assembly of the Tribes, because they're now going to be different tribes. This is how do you grow a republic that has a diverse group of tribes? Well, you do give some representation through the patricians, because they will be different wealthy patricians of the male men that are wealthy, a part of this assembly, the Assembly of the Tribes. Remember, at this time, they're controlling 24 neighboring tribes as colonies in that rich agricultural plain, geographic plain on the west side of Italy. So not much really changed in Rome's government in 509 BC, except who's going to replace the king? Two men are going to replace the king. One scholar in our day says the Republic of Rome was effectively set up overnight by the appointment of two consuls. Two consuls. So you still have the assembly, now it's the Assembly of the Tribes, and you still have the Senate, and now it's bigger. It's not 100 members, but 300. But the change is now they elect two consuls to replace the king. Okay? And those two consuls shared the power of the king, the imperium. So they then would be the head priest of the religion. They also would be the two commanders-in-chief of the army and head in times of peace. You see? Their office, though, is limited to a year. Limited to serving for 1 year, 1 year term. Two men taking on the imperium power of the king, serving 1 year terms. The Romans, why did they do this? The Romans were afraid that if any one man were made chief ruler, he would become too powerful. Like Lord Acton said, right? Power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Right? You have that worry. So they were like, we just got rid of the Tarquin the Proud, kicked out, we're no longer ever going to have a king. So let's put two people there with the imperial power where they're temporary, only serving 1 year. Well, there's one assembly I did not mention. It's called the Centuriated Assembly, Comitia Centuriata. You say, well, what in the world was that? That was established during the reign of the kings. It met at non-regular times. It represented the Roman soldiers, Roman people, the soldiers, gathering in their military units, the centuries. So their military units under the kings were called centuries. And they also had an assembly. So the soldiers were grouped into centuries, and then they would meet and vote on certain issues at non-regular times. Well, they elected the assembly of the centuries, of the soldiers, of the military, elected the two new consuls who would replace the king. Now, these two consuls, you remember, they're taking on the imperial power. They're the new commanders-in-chief. So it makes sense. You have these soldiers grouped in centuries. They're in the assembly of the centuries, and they vote in who's going to be their two commanders-in-chief of the military. Right? Makes sense. And they'd serve each then 1 year terms. I'll just add the assembly of the centuries, the centuriated assembly, not only elected the two council leaders, but also voted on declarations of war and treaties of peace and conducted capital trials. So you have the soldiers then voting on declarations of war and treaties of peace at this point, and then conducted capital trials. So it seems that Rome set up its aristocratic republic along similar lines as Sparta's military aristocratic republic in ancient Greece. It is not set up like Athens, a democratic republic. It is set up as an aristocratic republic. You get me? It is set up as an aristocratic republic. And I'm going to make arguments as to why here in a minute. We'll lay it out. But to stress, the American founders knew about the Roman Republic primarily by reading the histories of Polybius. Polybius lived, this Greek historian lived, from 200 BC to 118 BC. From 200 BC to 118 BC, 2nd century BC. He was a leading man of the Greek city of Megalopolis, which is southwest Greece, the Peloponnese Peninsula. It was north of Sparta. Okay? But he had been a leading man of the Greek city of Megalopolis, who for years lived as a hostage of Rome, but who understood the Roman genius and became an influential counselor to the principal Romans. And he wrote the histories. I was going to bring it, but it's about this thick. Okay, if you buy it with Penguin's classic book, you know, paperback. Well, Polybius asserted that the Roman Republic possessed a mixed constitution in which the two councils were to be the best of monarchy. They had the imperial power, right? So Publius asserted that the Roman Republic possessed a mixed constitution in which the councils, the Senate, and the people, meaning the citizens, the patricians, all shared power, and each required the cooperation of the other two in order to accomplish anything. There were checks and balances. The two councils, the Senate, and the patricians in assembly, and they also had the centuriated assembly, did indeed share political power, but it was not equal political power. You know, I've said it earlier, and I'll say it again here, a republic is a mixed form of government involving all three forms, monarchy, aristocracy, and democracy. You remember Aristotle said that's the best form, because you end up with the mean, right? He doesn't like the extremes. Aristotle, if you remember his philosophy. Well, what usually happens, though, is one of those three groups tends to dominate the decisions of the polis. As I've said, in Athens, it was a democratic republic, a mixed government, but yet the democracy part tended to dominate. As well, Sparta was an aristocratic republic, had each part as well of the three parts, but the aristocrats tended to dominate. So, one scholar of our day, Nathan Rosenstein, he states this, quote, "An aristocracy governed the Roman Republic from its foundation in 509 BC until Julius Caesar overthrew it in 44 BC. But he says clearly, an aristocracy governed the Republic. So I ask the question, how did the wealthy aristocrats dominate the Republic of Rome? This is something that's very important because it made Rome last a very long time as a republic. Remember, the golden age of Athens was about 50 years. And that's where we in our day, we have this, people like to say, oh, we're a democracy. I say, we're a republic. And I believe at the America's founding, it was meant to be an aristocratic republic with all three types. Presidency, the best of monarchy. The Senate, the best of aristocracy, and the U.S. House, the best of democracy. But what was to dominate in it all? I think aristocrat power, more along Rome's lines. Well, how did the wealthy aristocrats dominate the Republic of Rome? Well, in at least four primary ways. First, consider the two councils. Consider the two councils. The two councils were the chief executives. They exercised the imperial power which the king had possessed. They're to be the best of monarchy. Well, the two councils served one-year terms, but think, they already had to be members of the Senate. What was the Senate? The old men, the wealthy aristocrats. the heads of the patrician families. They already had to be members of the Roman Senate. So in reality, the two consuls were wealthy aristocratic senators exercising a temporary executive authority rather than independent elements of government. You get me? In a sense, it's just a bit more like what we would call prime minister, where the prime minister comes from parliament in a parliamentary system. Here, these two with executive power come from the Senate. And there are two senators granted executive power, the imperial power, for one-year terms. But that's where they're the wealthy aristocrats, being commanders-in-chief, right? Heads of the religion and leading in peace. Well, a second way the wealthy aristocrats dominated the Roman Republic is seen in how the centuriated assembly was organized. You remember that the military was divided in groups called centuries, and the assembly of these military centuries elected the two consuls as commanders-in-chief. Well, significantly, in the course of conducting the census was every 5 years. They continued that practice after the kings. Remember, they noted not just the number of people, not just their children, but their wealth, right? They listed their wealth. Significantly, in the course of conducting the census, the censors placed most citizens in one of six classes based on their wealth. It's a very complex system. Again, it's not one person, one vote. Far from it. So you have six classes based on your wealth. More wealthy are you in the top classes. And in the Roman Republic, there were 193 voting centuries. So the military was divided into centuries as groups. There were 193 of them. But they were distributed among those six classes in the centuriated assembly, the wealthiest in the top classes. And they were further divided by age, whether you were above or below age 46. Each century cast only one vote in their group. Each century casts only one vote based on the votes of a majority of its members, no matter how many citizens it contained. So let's say in the wealthiest first classes, there were less people, less citizens, less male patricians. But in the lower ones, you had a lot higher number. But in each group, you say, do you want to vote for A or B? If majority said A, then that's the one vote out of that century, A. Well, the distribution of the centuries was heavily weighted to the wealthiest class of citizens. Since voting began with the wealthiest first class and proceeded until a majority was reached and then stopped, it is unclear how often those in the poorer, lower census classes ever cast a vote. It is an aristocratic republic that defends property, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The way John Locke wrote it was life, liberty, and property. It should be one of the main purposes of a republic is protecting private property, not being a communist socialist regime that's there to redistribute as the nanny state. The wealthy Roman aristocrats were fewer citizens in number, but filled the upper classes of centuries, whereas the poor lower classes had many more citizens in their centuries, but would not always have an opportunity to vote in the assembly of the centuries, because a majority may have already been reached before it ever got to them. We have that sometimes in the presidential primaries, where it's already picked before we ever get to Minnesota. And that's why they want to front-load certain states to favor their position. Whether you want certain states that are going to favor a liberal Republican versus a conservative Republican. Which states gets to vote first gets to shape who that will be. The structure of everything is many times more important than anything. And you see it, though, in the Roman Republic as well. Okay, what's a third way that the wealthy aristocrats dominated the Roman Republic, and it's seen in how the assembly of the tribes was organized and where this assembly was required to vote. When the assembly of the tribes voted to approve proposed laws, so they were about voting on laws, the citizens, again, voted as groups. Here there was 35 tribes. During the time of the kings, there were 30. Time of the Republic, it was 35 tribes. And it was set at that period, no matter how big it got. So if more were added as they grew, they added more citizens, you were put then as a voting citizen in one of the tribes. It was only 35 tribes. But again, each tribe only had one vote. So if whatever the majority in that tribe said, we want Proposition A to become law, well, then that's the one vote that came out of that tribe. Well, what's the problem here? Well, over time, the bigger the Republic got, all the voting took place at Rome. And there was no opportunity or way to vote anywhere else. And these tribes came to resemble a patchwork made up of non-contiguous lands. More gerrymandered than U.S. congressional districts. But you were allotted wherever your colony was, and a citizen of Rome, way out in the outskirts of the Roman Republic, you were assigned to one of the 35 tribes, but you had to get back to the city of Rome to vote. Well, not everybody could do that, right? So it became harder and harder to cast your vote in the assembly of the tribes, and there was no provision on voting anywhere else outside of Rome. Anyone in or near Rome could easily vote, which tended to be more the wealthy aristocrats. And if you were poor in and around Rome, then you could be influenced by the wealthy aristocrats. And that was one way then that the wealthy aristocrats in and around Rome then could affect the vote of the assembly of the tribes. As I noted earlier, it wasn't until 286 BC that all the plebeians were admitted to full Roman citizenship. Okay, what's a fourth reason that the wealthy aristocrats dominated, that this was an aristocratic republic? The wealthy senators served for life. They served for life. And therefore dominated the republic's government. In fact, one scholar notes, quote, all of the republic's higher magistrates were senior senators. All of the republic's higher magistrates were senior senators. Who were the senators? They were the 300 elderly, elite, wealthy aristocrats, the heads of the patrician families. So in sum, the Roman Republic functioned as an aristocratic republic. Now, the longest, you know, some would say one of the longest republics of ancient Greece was Sparta, which was an aristocratic republic. Military aristocratic republic, but an aristocratic republic. And here we have a very long-lasting republic, and what was it? An aristocratic republic. Whereas the Democratic Republic didn't last very long in Athens. Golden Age there was 50 years. Which again was one of the reasons why our founders of America studied Rome's Republic more than Athens. Because they wanted a long-lasting republic, a successful long-lasting republic. Though the Roman Republic was an aristocratic republic, it did become more democratic over time, but particularly in legal reforms. Remember that in Roman society, the wealthy few were the patricians, and most of the people were the poor plebeians, the common folk farmers. Now, they were given full voting citizenship in 286 BC. Okay, so we'll be getting to that next week and how they expanded and go through that period of time. But that changes Rome somewhat, too, when you give the plebs full voting citizenship, okay? And that's a question in my mind when you study these, is when the more democratic Athens got, the more democratic Rome got, the Roman Republic, it may have heightened and sped up their fall. Okay? Well, once the Roman Republic was formed in 509 BC, modern scholars have termed the period Rome entered into as the conflict of the orders, the conflict of the orders, in which the plebes demanded voting citizenship, which they eventually got in 286 BC, quite a bit of time later, from 509 BC. But what was granted to them for more influence in the government, more favorable laws to define their rights, in 494, pretty soon after the formation of the Republic in 509 BC, in 494 BC, the patricians allowed the plebes to form their own assembly, the Consilium Plebis, to elect their own leaders to kind of govern their own affairs on things. And it was formalized in 471 BC. So it was kind of a separate thing to kind of govern their own affairs on certain things. In 451 BC, the plebes demanded the establishment of a board of 10 officials called the Decemviri to publish a written code of laws. And together, these laws formed the famous 12 tribes. It was in Roman numerals. So it was called the famous 12 tables, which became key founding elements of Roman law. Key founding elements of Roman law came about because of the plebes through their assembly, and they demanded the establishment of a board of 10 officials to publish a written code of laws. Now, what's really significant, these 12 tables became the key founding elements of Roman law, but where did they go to for wisdom? Significantly, 3 out of the 10 officials on the board were sent to Athens. This is 451 BC. You are at the golden age of Athens, of its republic at that time. And the 3 out of the 10 officials on the board were sent to Athens to research their laws, and they returned with copies of the laws of the famous Athenian political and religious reformer Solon, and the laws that he wrote in 594 BC, about 150 years earlier. I have a book that is about this thick paperback of his laws. Only partial parts of it remain today of Solon's reforms from 594, of his laws. So I've got a book just on his laws and goes through the fragments that we have. And it's the same with the 12 tables. We do not have a complete set of these 12 tables of their laws, of the 12 tables of laws in the ancient Roman Republic here in 451 BC. Only fragments of the 12 tables survive today, but they do give glimpses into Roman society. Again, it was the key founding elements of Roman law. It classified citizens based on property ownership or lack thereof. It established certain procedures to settle disputes. How are you going to settle disputes? This is the rule of law. We go to court to settle our differences. We don't go to the corner and shoot it out like barbarians. We are civilized people. We have ordered liberty and the rule of law, right? Same with God. As we went through Jerusalem in Deuteronomy chapter 19, the rule of witnesses, God established courts in every city of Israel, and they were at the gates of every city, right? The elders, and that's where the courts were. God established the rule of law and procedures for settling differences. We're not barbarians in Western civilization. We have procedures, we have courts, and the rule of law, ordered liberty. They had particular laws regarding property rights, slaves, marriage, divorce, inheritance, punishment, etc. Now, I'll just say some of the punishments were quite severe. Won't go into all of that, but some of the punishments were, most would probably regard as cruel and unusual today if they were to read them. But they had all of these laws on all sorts of different things, so that the plebs said, we want these 12 tables, we want laws clearly written, we know what our rights are, and all these things. Removes arbitrariness. So during the Roman Republic, Rome was governed primarily by the wealthy aristocratic senators, but to appease the majority of their populace, the plebs, who eventually were given full voting citizenship in 286. Lord willing, we'll get into that next class. But here, right at the beginning, they're granting them their own plebeian assembly to kind of govern their own affairs, as well meeting their demands of putting together that board of 10 members to research and write their laws on 12 tables on all these various topics for their society so that everyone knows what their rights are, that they are a civilized society in the Republic with the rule of law. They have their two councils functioning the best of monarchy. They have the Senate, and they have different assemblies for different purposes of the male patricians and later the male plebs added. And that is their aristocratic republic. So, Lord willing, the next time we meet, I want to get into the expansion of the Roman Republic, and we'll cover that period of time, how they expanded and grew very successfully, and then toward more their decline and why. We'll end next class probably around Cicero. So that's where we want to get to that point. And then the class after that, we want to spend some time on Cicero, because Cicero is very important for the American founders, very important for the American Republic, the writings and beliefs of Cicero. The American founders spent much time pondering and reading him. So, Lord willing, that'll be the next class.